Good. Okay, hello. Welcome to the Totalitarians course. This is Hunt Tooley again, coming to you from Texas, actually. And this is the Ludwig von Mises Institute Mises Academy course on the Totalitarians. And here we go. We're marking off our weeks. Now we've knocked out four, and today we talk about Hitler, Stalin, and Mussolini. Next week, we delve into the crimes of the total state. We do some comparing, and we introduce some the beginnings of some other regimes next week, or the week after that, and then the other totalitarians. We make a little bit more in the way of a general comparison and talk about some more recent totalitarians in the last week. So today we got Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini, and I'm going to take it in the order Mussolini first, then Lenin and Stalin, and then we'll go to Hitler last. For one thing, I think that we need to talk more about Mussolini because he is the inventor, in a sense, of the term totalitarian, or at least the popularizer. Some friends of his basically, I suppose, made up the word. But it also happens to be the case, I think, among most of us, that we know less about Mussolini and more about Hitler. And it also happens that in the popular mind, I don't think among this group, but in the popular mind, there is this sense that Mussolini is right up there in terms of his crimes and his brutality, along with the other big totalitarians, Stalin and Lenin and Hitler. This is not quite the case, but he's certainly laying the basis for this. I mean, he only Italy was only a little less brutal in its totalitarian tendencies, but for reasons that we will see. So. Let's think about Mussolini and the fascist movement from the 1920s, and we will begin. He was a person, as you know from your reading. He was a person born in the Romagna in central Italy, a town called Forli, and his father was a craftsman, a working man. And his father was, in fact, a very committed sort of leftist. In fact, it's really interesting where you don't get much of a sense of Lenin and Stalin being influenced by fathers at all, and certainly not by Hitler, only except perhaps in his case in a negative sense. You really get the sense that Mussolini was a sort of following in the father's old footsteps, you know, following the acorn doesn't fall far from the tree, and all of that. His father was a kind of hero of socialism, but also this anarcho-syndicalism, which in spite of its kind of urban feel, and in spite of its what you might say, you know, its attachment to the general strike and your idea that this is all really about factories, huge factories in Barcelona striking and that type of thing. Well, in fact, anarcho-syndicalism also had these other aspects that appealed to this working man in a small Italian town. And it has a bit of the heroic in it, as we'll see later. Mussolini was influenced by these kind of leftist sorts of things. Italian Social Revolution. I'll skip Nietzsche for just a moment and say that from the time of the whole movement for what the Italians called the Risorgimento, the resurging, the rebirth of the idea of a real Italy, a national Italy, in the late 18th century, early 19th century, there, because the country was occupied by other powers, by foreign powers, there was a sense that that there had to be some kind of conspiratorial background, and Mussolini's father was thinking back to the old Carbonari movement from the 1830s to the 1840s, the sort of secret subterranean plots to overthrow the government, and he thought these were noble. And that comes into it also. It's a part and parcel of the background. It's a little bit different from the national backgrounds of the other totalitarians. Mussolini was certainly influenced by Nietzsche. I'm not sure he was influenced in all ways by Nietzsche. Certainly, he didn't accept many of the conclusions, I think, of Nietzsche's philosophy. But what he latched onto was that element in Nietzsche which was about sort of pulling yourself up by the bootstraps, this strong, tough kind of demeanor where every person makes his own future, et cetera, et cetera. And with Nietzsche, it was certainly his future and not his or her future. I mean, you just don't find much like that. It's very sort of macho interpretation of Nietzsche, and that's what that's kind of what Mussolini took from Nietzsche, that aspect. The Risorgimento I've mentioned already, that was carried through by not only the politicians, Cavour and King Victor Emmanuel in 1859 and 60 and 61, but also by the great theorist, the fiery theorist of Italian nationalism, Giuseppe Mazzini, whom we have talked about before. These were fiery collectivist nationalists who wanted to group the nations together and have these nations work as one and feel their kinship. It's this kind of romantic nationalist movement that arose in the early 19th century, which influenced Mussolini as well. You know, in a sense, he's mixing here some things that from the beginning we don't usually associate together. In other words, a kind of internationalist anarcho-syndicalism, international socialism, and then this intense nationalism and this almost mystical feeling of what it means to be in a kind of national community. So, in a sense, there's a kind of mishmash going on here. There is an opposition, a national opposition to Austria because of all the foreign powers that remained in power over Italian territory. Austria was the most important one. Austria had ruled much of Italy up until the late 19th century, and still controlled a little bit of what the Italians always called unredeemed Italy, Italia irredenta. So there's that opposition to Austria that kind of makes Mussolini, and that's in there too, that sense of getting rid of the foreigners, that sense of fighting them where we can. And I think this is especially important when the First World War started. I think that this then becomes a kind of emotional a part of Mussolini's ideology. Mysticism is a big part of all this for sure. Mussolini and the nationalist movement had a kind of spiritual aspect to it, a kind of almost magical aspect. And this began, this really shot through for Mussolini what were various kinds of backgrounds. If you think about it, there's a side of Nietzsche that's sort of, well, you push yourself forward, and then these almost kind of mystical things happen that you become this authentic human being through your own efforts, and it's not really clear, it's not really some kind of scientific recipe, it's a kind of mystical recipe. Same way with Mazzini's nationalism, his emphasis on heroism, what we would call charisma, spiritually imbued sort of sense. this bonds together with the heroic past. I've mentioned Mazzini twice already, but there's also the famous Garibaldi, Giuseppe Garibaldi, who you see a photograph of there, swashbuckling in his red shirt. He led the, of course, the famous expedition from northern Italy to Sicily to put down the Bourbon armies and help create the unification of Italy. Arguably one of the great soldiers who ever lived, and one of the great partisan fighters, and one of the great rabble rousers, etc., etc., and also a very snazzy dresser, as you can see there. And I say this as a kind of joke that Mussolini was influenced by a very deep fashion sense. But on the other hand, there's important things about that in that Mussolini kind of charted the territory for a certain branch of totalitarianism that was kind of stylish and cool. I mean, unlike Lenin, whose pictures all look scruffy and down at the heels, and he kind of affected to look like the workers with whom he supposedly identified. Not so with the fascists or the Nazis. They really got into the kind of show and the theater of absolutism. And I think this comes partly from the idea of mysticism. It comes partly from the ideas of the heroic past. And both for Italy and later for Germany, both in the Italian fascist movement and the German Nazi movement, there is this sense in all of it that connects appearance and sort of coolness and sort of a fashion statement with what they call the leadership principle. Hitler emphasized that explicitly more than Mussolini did, but Mussolini's certainly all about the bold leader taking charge. And once that bold leader takes charge, then mystical great kinds of things happen. And so you see Mussolini there in Rome, and boy, does he ever have a great outfit on, those high boots and cool uniform and a hat and so forth. And, you know, it's also the case, if you think about the way these totalitarian regimes have sort of echoed, you can see the imitations, especially in the Middle East, where actually Mussolini's movement has turned out to be quite influential. I think that the Falange party in Lebanon and the whole Gaddafi phenomenon in Libya, which had, of course, had very close connections to Italy in the period of imperialism and otherwise, then you see these kinds of things echo. And if you wondered if Gaddafi had had a sort of precursor in this fashion sense that he had, well, I think we're looking at it here. Well, let's examine for a moment what the what fascism basically refers to in its essential name. The fasci, which is one of those plural words that means a singular thing. But here's how the word sort of works out. The Romans called the Romans had a word for bundle, just simply bundle, not bundle of anything, but bundle, and that was fascis. Okay. But the Romans, when they pluralized that word, they did it to represent a concept in the way that we pluralize a word and we use it as in a plural pronunciation, but it has a specific meaning, like politics, et cetera, et cetera. So when the Romans pluralized fascis, the bundle, what they referred to was, I mean, it technically says bundles, but what they were referring to was this symbol of authority, a bundle of sticks with an axe sticking out of the side or out of the end. And the meaning is, I mean, it's not, I don't think, all that far to seek. It means something like a pluribus unum. There's a lot of sticks there and one axe that's sort of guarding over everything. Or or that the power of the authority over a whole bunch of entities, something like that. And this is a symbol that's been used a lot in European history because it was used a lot in Roman history. It's reflected down in all throughout medieval Europe and early modern Europe. The Palace of Versailles is filled up with symbol fasces in the English, if we want to say it that way. And Louis the 14th is holding as many fasces or bundles of these things as you can imagine. And it comes down in many, many ways to the present. I understand the Swiss Civil Guard has that as its representation. It's in the seals of many state organizations of all kinds. As you can see on the lower right there on this slide, the National Guard Bureau, a particular office within the military, has crossed fasces as a part of their symbol along with the eagle. And the older dime, it's changed a little bit now. It looks more like a torch now. Although I don't know, there's a kind of fasces element in the current dime. But the older dime, this one's from the 30s. That's the old Mercury dime. Had a quite clear fasces on it with the inscription "E pluribus unum." So it's again sort of the same kind of sense there. There's an old badge from the 1860s. That was the Baltimore Police Department badge and had one on it. So I don't know if they had fascist tendencies or not. I suppose that might be endemic. But in any case, this is the meaning of the term, and it just happened to be a popular designation for the many left-wing social revolutionary groups, or even not so much revolutionary, but socially left-wing groups in Italy in the late 19th century. It could be any so the group would call itself, instead of the group for social improvement, it would call itself the fasci of social improvement. Here's an example of just one of many, many fasci that existed. And I just want to get this clear in your mind. I mean, it's something that most people don't take time to figure out. But one of the many fasci was the movement of the Sicilian workers, fasces, however you want to say it. 1893-94, and this is it was a kind of uprising, and they took over a town. Actually, these were kind of anarchists, and they did take over a town or two, and these towns really kind of liked it. I mean, it was in a part of Italy that was quite anarchistic in that, in some sense, whether left or right, and people were not all that unhappy. You realize there that there's a lot of red in that picture, and there's a little red flag of anarchism and all that. And so, they were opposed by government forces, and you can see the soldiers there shooting at the celebrating workers and anarchists. And then they were put on trial and taken to court. And this is the Il Movimento dei Fasci Siciliani dei Lavatori, the movement of the Sicilian fascists of the workers. So it's a designation that was popular. It was quite right within Mussolini's whole sense of being and his father's whole sense of being. And so it's quite normal that Mussolini would think of this word later on. Well, Mussolini, as we had discussed before in this course, Mussolini was a member of the left, and he's kind of an odd spokesman for international socialism, since he was, in fact, so conflicted in that he liked the anarchist version, the anarcho-syndicalist version of the left. Actually, as much as he thought of himself as a Marxist, probably more. In fact, I think he didn't much, have much regard for the Marxist side, though he was the editor of Avanti, which was the newspaper of the Italian Socialist Party. So before the war, he was a socialist. He was identified with the working class. He was supposed to be read in that political sense. And let me ask, let me check again to make sure everybody's hearing me, because I realize I've got one connection that could be a little bit better. Oh, are we all fine? I just want to make sure. I hope that doesn't blip us off, but if it does, it's for the greater good. Just want to make sure I'm on a good connection. And I will check the chat line to make sure we're... Okay, sorry for this interruption. Okay, very good. Thank you. Great. Perfect. Okay, so so Mussolini is before the war a socialist, and therefore you would think might in some way oppose the war, although we've seen the socialists already in Germany going over to the war, and the socialists in Italy, in France going over to the war. So a lot of these, a lot of this internationalist talk about the war being the result of imperialists fighting each other, which of course it was, a lot of that just kind of dissolved once push came to shove, and these different parties were able to persuade themselves, especially the kind of centralized Marxist parties, persuade themselves that that the war was a good thing for the country to do for one tactical reason or the other. Italy waited. The king waited, the cabinet waited. Italy had been previously on the side of the Central Powers, but had been dislodged before the war and had gone over to the Entente. And the first big diplomatic struggle of the First World War was on the part of Britain and France to get Italy into the war, to put more pressure on Austria, more pressure on Austria's ally Germany to create another front to draw off forces. And so once Italy entered the war in 1915, then there really it really and truly did this. There was a very extensive battlefront of World War I in Italy. You see Switzerland up in the left-hand corner of this map. Writing is not that clear, but there's Switzerland up here, and you see then this long, and this is quite a long battlefront that goes right, for the most part, on ridges of basically the Southern Alps. So for Italy, the whole war was fought on along different sections here. It dips down below the Trentino, moves back up to Carinthia, Carinthian in German, and along the Carnic Alps, as they're called, and then all the way down out of the mountains to the sea. So it's a huge front, and three separate ones with many minor ones. There was a special kind of horror to this mountain war in that it was cold, it was extremely dangerous. Artillery had to be struggled up these mountains, up in these remote places. If you think about it, if there was ever any place you didn't want to be firing off an artillery piece, it's up in the high Alps where about a zillion tons of snow might be dislodged onto you at any moment. And indeed, this an avalanche has happened all the time up there, the result of artillery firing. On one day, 10,000 men on both sides were killed in an avalanche, one single day, the worst of those days. So it's an awful war, just like any war is awful, but this one had its own particular horrors and sacrifices on the part of the troops And so it's an important thing that happened. It's not just like they had some little remote war. There were hundreds of thousands of losses. The Austrians, later the Austrians and Germans, made big inroads. It looked like they were almost threatening Venice and that whole area. And so it's a very ugly war. It's a version of trench warfare, but over the tops of mountains. That's particularly difficult. So Italy in the First World War, they certainly had a First World War. There's a picture of some battlefront kinds of activities, supplies being trucked up and down these very, very steep mountains. And if you're familiar with that, with northern Italy and those mountains, you know that they can be pretty much straight up and down. So there's that part. There's the battlefront. And then on the home front, where Italy as a country that was not on par with the first industrial powers, had a lot of industry, was very kind of Western European in the north, but in the whole south of Italy, the old Magna Graecia, the toe of the and the bottom of the foot of Italy, all that area very much agrarian, very poor. Sicily, the same way. These places that were pouring out immigrants all over the world, especially to the United States. There's a reason they were, and that was because it was an uneven economy in that sense, and there was a lot of overpopulation. The land tenure situation was unfavorable in the south. And so it's a country that looks like it's ready for modern industrial war, but it really wasn't. And so as a result, there was widespread hunger and poverty in Italy, although there's plenty of help coming in to try to take up the slack. This is an American Red Cross place where children are coming with their little lunch pails to get some food, and I think pointer out, you can see us there. That's Croce Rossa Americana. And so Italy has an economy that wears out as the war goes on. And this is a common theme in the war. And Italy was not, it didn't have that much slack to worry about. Well, Mussolini had a conversion experience, you might say, and I put this in quotation marks. Here are the stages of it. I think it's a very interesting kind of progression. Mussolini, who was the head of the socialist newspaper, the Avanti, once the war started, not once Italy was in, but once the war started, Mussolini began to add up all these different influences that we've already discussed and to come up with a kind of new idea that socialism shouldn't be an international thing. Socialism should be something like Mazzini suggested in the 19th century. It should be something that's a group project of those who are like you, those who are born into a relationship, the relationship of nationalism that Mises discussed so much in Omnipotent Government. And so so Mussolini is thinking now about what the tactic should be. I mean, he's one of the party bigwigs of the Socialist Party, but what should the tactic of the people of Italy be? And he founds a newspaper, the Italian People, November 1914, and he had, by this time, established the goal of getting Italy into the war. He thought that Italy had to get into the war to fight for its own future, and that was the aim of the paper. And it's in this newspaper, Il Popolo d'Italia, that he developed many of his ideas about what should come in the future. Really quite an astonishing part of the later fascist program. It's going to be worked up through the first months of this newspaper. In December 1914, he came out quite clearly denouncing Orthodox socialism and essentially saying that national identity is it's a greater bond, a more sacred bond than class identity. He joined the army when Italy got into the war. He went to the front, was on the in these trenches up in the mountains for 9 months, was wounded, was blown up, had an honest to goodness, genuine World War I experience as a soldier. You see him there, all decked out. And what with being in the army, being wounded, convalescing, he didn't get out until 1917. And he came back to his people there in around the newspaper Il Popolo d'Italia, and also a number of other groups. Let me see if I have the name of these groups. I'll let me go to this line, and I'll go back to the other. The sidebar here is that in September 1914, Mussolini formed the Fasci Autonomi d'Azione Rivoluzionaria. That's the Fasci, the Autonomous Fasci of Action, Revolutionary Action, sorry. It's mostly violence-prone syndicalists now, like Mussolini, focusing on the nation. So it's a small group, this Fasci Autonomi d'Azione. So then October 1914, he joined another group with a similar name together with his own group to create an organization that everybody was calling the Milan Fasci, and that was expanding all over Italy by the time that he went off to the front. So he leaves and goes to the front, keeps in touch, there's organizational things going on, and so this movement has been in existence since then. So I should have put all this on one sheet, but I didn't manage to do that. So he gets back and is recruited into British military intelligence by Samuel Hoare, the head of what was then called the British Overseas Intelligence Unit. That's what later became MI5. And he recruited Mussolini as a British agent. And then he supplied him with about 40,000 of today's amounts, $40,000 per month, to energize Italy, to keep the country in the war, to bolster up the Italian sort of fighting will. So here we have the another case of intelligence. We got to address this at some point, the extent to which military intelligence or spy networks or espionage or counter-espionage was involved in the origins of well, so far, all of our guys. And we will discuss that later. But here it's quite direct. Mussolini gets in the beginning. You see at the top of this slide, he's being financed by Italy's leading arms manufacturer. I guess I forgot to say that. He's being financed by Italy's leading arms manufacturer, also by France, and by the end he's being financed by British intelligence, and he becomes essentially an agent of British military intelligence. So, well, all right. So much for his ideas about national, you know, pulling yourself up by the bootstraps. I don't think Nietzsche would have approved of this. In any case, the war ends, and the Italians win. They're on the winning side, but they're pretty angry. And indeed, it becomes very clear by the time the peace conference starts and the Italian delegation gets there, it becomes very clear that that France and Britain and the United States are going to double-cross them and not give them all their promised loot that they were promised for getting into the war. And so there's a sense in Italy that the Italians have fought the war and sacrificed their sons and made all these huge sacrifices of a terrible economy and the rationing and all these other things and the ruining of their currency by inflation and all of this. just to not get anything. They want some loot for it. I mean, that's been the whole thing, that the country's going to get bigger and better and more expansive and become, once again, a kind of Roman Empire. And so people are, you know, kind of disappointed at this. And so Mussolini's able to make the most of it, and what with this British money, in the spring of 1919, Mussolini formed the Fasci Italiani di Combattimento. So that's the Italian Fasci of Combat. And their aim now is, of course, not to get into the war or stay in the war, it's to get the most out of the peace. Well, what with what happens next is that the fascist party begins to recruit in much broader, the fascist movement, the Fasci Italiani di Combattimento, and related small groups that are connected to Mussolini, begin to, well, terrorize their town, terrorize their city, especially go against socialists, especially go against liberals, especially go against people to take over in local disputes. To oftentimes they, you know, they're accustomed to taking money from factory owners already. I mean, that's how the Mussolini got started, and these people who are saying that they're members of some workers' movement. They begin to get to side with factory owners and get paid by them to break strikes and so forth, and that's how they occupy their time until November 7, 1921, when all of these were coalesced into one big group called the National Fascist Party, Partito Nazionale Fascista. How this all happened was, how they got involved in all these disputes was that. Mussolini oversaw the founding of a paramilitary group called Squadristi. These are the people we call the Black Shirts. Squadristi founded in 1919, and these guys are the ones who hired out as goons for the chiefs of industry and the landlords and so forth, so that when there would be a strike or something, they would be the provide the muscle to put down the strike or put down the local rebellion. In many cases, the Squadristi carried out violence in all directions against all opponents and just ended up in charge. In other words, they had, by violence, taken over many areas on the countryside. And you see, they were saying that they were justified in doing this because so many of them had this kind of anarcho-syndicalist bent. I really think that many of these fascist goons thought that they were setting up sort of anarcho-syndicalist settlements when they took over towns and regions and assassinated the mayors and assassinated the heads of the socialist newspapers and assassinated anybody who opposed them. Well, this went on during 1919 and 1920. 21 also, and the Italians were especially bitter that even though they had pushed at the Paris Peace Conference in 1919 and 20 for a lot of loot, they especially wanted territory on the Dalmatian coast, and they wanted more territory in the north along that huge battle line, and they wanted some colonial territory and influence. But this actually was counterbalanced by Wilson's desire to reward Serbia and Serbians and some other powers, and so Italy kind of got edged out. Of course, at one point, Orlando, who was the Italian prime minister, left the peace conference in the spring of 1919. He was furious that he wasn't going to get all these promised pieces of the rock, so to speak, and he went back to Italy and he told the parliament that he had returned from Paris with clean hands, and they practically mobbed him in the parliament and said, "Are you crazy? Get back there. We don't want clean hands. We want territory. Give us territory." So he went back and did what he could. Still problematic, though. So there's a sense in Italy, and of course they don't do what they might do in any economic situation, just let the laissez-faire, laissez-passer, just let it happen. And so the economy got worse. The social background got worse. More and more people were out of work. All the brutalized soldiers from the front were back looking for something to do. They provided grist for the mills of the Squadristi. And so push came to shove. Mussolini called for a march on Rome, the famous March on Rome in 1922. They really didn't ever, they marched to Rome, but they never marched into it, actually. Once the fascists, about 30,000 of them gathered outside of Rome in October 1922. Then the king said, well, it's about time to make a change here. So he called for a new government, and Mussolini said, well, I'll be in your government. And they said, well, you'll take a minor post. And he said, yeah, that's fine. But once they got into the negotiations, he said, I have these 30,000 people who are about to come in the city and tear it limb from limb and march on Rome. So what's your play now? And so they made him prime minister. So Mussolini ruled as head of a coalition government from 1922 to 1924. This is a strange episode where the royal king invites this anarcho-syndicalist, supposedly an anarcho-syndicalist, to be the prime minister. But it's also true that this is a part of the way that the Italian democratic parliamentary system had developed. They had a highly developed sense of what they called trasformismo. In the Italian system, that developed in the 1870s and 1880s, in which there was always some wild and crazy party on the outside, some wild and crazy politician on the outside, and they worked and worked against them until it seemed irresistible. Then they would bring that politician to the inside, into the cabinet, and to carry out something like taming him with power, you know, showing him how difficult the situation really was, show him how bad things really were, how hard the issues were to solve things, and why not just relax and enjoy the corruption of being in government and rule that way in a normal kind of democratic parliamentary way. And it usually worked. Trasformismo usually had worked in the system in that it just kept, you know, kind of, it removed the, you might say, the reform movements or quieting them down. But in this case, I think that's what they intended. I mean, Victor Emmanuel and all the liberal politicians or middle-class politicians and nationalist politicians, they all thought, well, this guy's bark can't be, his bite can't be as bad as his bark. We'll bring him in. We'll show him how difficult it all is. We'll give him a sinecure. We'll make him happy. He'll see what a cool thing it is to be in the government and to not make waves, and then he will become one of us. However, Mussolini is head of the government, and he is ruling with the coalition government from 1922 to 1924. He just spent this time, he was just more self-directed than they thought he would be. He was more intent on changes than they thought he would be. And he had worked out a whole new, he thought, ideology, and he began to install that. And electorally, and from a parliamentary standpoint, he just did a lot of gerrymandering in that period from 1922 to 1924. He just changed the voting laws in this way and that way and the other way, so that eventually, by the time we get to 1924, basically there's no way that the fascists are not going to win a majority. And once they have the majority, then he's able to introduce one-party rule. And the counterpoint to all this is assassination, intimidation, bashing in the windows of the opponents, killing some of the opponents. A famous socialist called Matteotti demanded that the most recent of the outrageous electoral scams be repealed in 1924. He was murdered, and this is really seen as the beginning of the rule of the one-party state. So there's a couple of years there in a coalition government. Well, meanwhile, the friends of Mussolini and had invented the term totalitarianism, and Mussolini accepted it with great enthusiasm. The originators were Giovanni Amendola and Giovanni Gentile, who were thinking along these lines. I mean, they're influenced so much by the interventionism in all regimes in World War I. They're influenced so much. I mean, if you remember in that Hindenburg Program article, you remember Walter Rathenau, the German head of General Electric, writes in his book, you know, this is, we've done some great things in this war. We've redefined what it means to confiscate things from people. And so there's all these redefinitions that have happened in the war, and these scholars, intellectuals, journalists who are grouped around Mussolini, some of them quite brilliant, artists as well. A number of quite famous artists flocked to the fascist party, but these folks thought that their new ideology was something completely different. They thought of it as a third way, not liberal parliamentary constitutional government, not some kind of old authoritarian government, usually the rule of the kings or whatever, not that, but something completely different, okay? So that's important to kind of think about for a moment. As Mussolini put it quite approvingly of this word, what it means is that everything is within the state, nothing is outside the state, and nothing is against the state. So the state then becomes the embodiment of everything. It's really Leviathan-like. It really harkens back to Hobbes and his even that illustration of the from the frontispiece of Leviathan, if you can recall that, this big king-like creature rising out, and he's made up of all the bodies of everybody. So everybody is the state, says Mussolini. The theory includes an insistence that totalitarianism has to be a popular regime, and it certainly is true that the fascist regimes are always holding plebiscites and getting confirmation, whether they're fair or not, whether the elections are fair or not, whether they're really true, they're always getting confirmation from the people. It's kind of a plebiscitary sort of regime in their minds, and it's and popular. I mean, as we all know, totalitarianism had the ability with this sort of charisma on the part of the fascist and the Nazi regimes to really grip people. To some extent, Stalinism did as well. A little bit different, I would say, in not the way that Hitler and Mussolini worked it out, but there's a kind of positive aspect, and you see that shadowy picture in the background. You can recognize the Heil Hitler arms and all that. I mean, you know, if you think about these films of the party rallies, if you think about scenes from Mussolini speaking in the center of Rome, and all these people just going crazy. There is this kind of charisma there, this kind of appeal to people that's many of them call mesmerizing and hypnotizing. So there's that sort of popular level. The theory was also that there was a low level of corruption in these regimes, or should be. That in fact was not the case, but that was the window dressing, that these were regimes coming from the old corrupt system of parliamentary horse trading and kind of pork barrel politics and that kind of thing, that the new regimes, especially in the Mussolini's case, in the Italian case, the new regime would be would have no corruption. It's all about balancing people's interests. There was certainly to be a guiding ideology, and that was an ideology of totalitarianism, or Mussolini actually preferred the idea of corporatism, totalitarianism as the bigger category, and the particular way that that the Italians would carry it out, that the fascists would carry it out, would be corporatism, which we'll talk about in a moment. There's no private sphere. Total economic interventionism. These were the ideas that he said. And when I say total economic interventionism, in the case of Mussolini, certainly what emerged was another variety of the pattern that we know so well. That is to say, an economy that is an interventionist economy. The government favors certain companies. Those become really big. Everybody else has to watch their backs. These big companies then receive their rent, the great rent-seeking classes. They receive all the largesse of the government and become, in effect, a kind of part of the government, carrying out its wishes and making all the profit along the way. So that's the kind of interventionism that he's thinking of. Hannah Arendt, I guess I misspelled Hannah, I argued that this was a new kind of authoritarianism, that it was that this plebiscitary, this plebiscitary tying everything in was completely different from things in the past. I would argue it's very much a kind of Robespierrean, Rousseauian approach, but I'm not sure that that's absolutely crucial. I think that Mises, as we've read the Omnipotent Government, certainly puts all of this on a kind of continuum. I mean, one of the great things about Mises is that although he's perfectly capable of splitting the thinnest of hairs, we know that when he talks about some things, he says, "Well, you know, this is you can talk all day about this variety of totalitarianism or that, but the effect is the same. If they just have chose to organize it in one way or the other, so." I think Mises would disagree that this was new in kind, maybe a new variety, a new take on an old thing. Karl Popper thought that totalitarian systems were all marked by the movement toward a kind of immutable future according to the laws laid down in the ideology. And he was certainly thinking about the Italian case, where Italy was supposed to become great, to become an empire, to rule once again on at least part of the territory of the Roman Empire, but become this big, energetic, modern kind of thing. You know, I should have put here also that all the totalitarian movements had a commitment to technology and speed and cars and airplanes and radio and movies. They were very, very forward looking. A great American historian, Jeffrey Herf, has written a book called Reactionary Modernism, and it's about the extent to which especially the Hitler regime, but also other totalitarian regimes, have tended to look toward technology. I mean, even the Soviets are electrifying the countryside and building the hydroelectric dams. It kind of goes part and parcel with their program. As we'll see, Hitler installed the programs to motorize the country, and he sponsored this amalgamation that became this state or a corporation called Volkswagen and built the autobahns and all that. Well, Mussolini did the same thing, and there was a fascination with that. There was a forward lookingness to that, and it was very artful as well. He had on his side as one of his very important members of the party the artist Marinetti, who was sort of on the ground floor of the futurist movement in art, and there is this kind of dynamism toward the future. You know, Mussolini, as somebody if somebody, well, it Cam points out a couple of things, but certainly the trains ran on time. I mean, for the first time, which was no small thing in Italy. I mean, there is this sense of modernizing and so forth. There's a lot of admiration around for Italy, modernizing Italy, and all these Europeans who love to go to Italy but knew that you could wait for 5 hours at a train station and miss your next 3 days worth of trains just because somebody wanted to stop and barter for chickens along the way or something. So there is that sense too. There's this kind of forward looking kind of thing. I point out that Mussolini built this whole big city that he was deeply involved in sort of modernist architecture, and his regime did all those things. So this is one element. I mean, all the totalitarians certainly want to rebuild the world in their image, and that goes from Robespierre onward. They all want to do that, but their image of the world is it varies from place. Okay, Mussolini is very, very interested in saying that the ideology of fascism is corporatism, and we use this a lot today in the liberty movement. You might say we talk a lot about corporatism, and here's what Mussolini meant by it. It's just a little piece I wrote. It's just a short summary. Corpora means bodies in Latin, and in medieval times there was an idea that modern historians call corporatism, because society was thought of as being organized not by individuals but by bodies. All the peasants of a given region, all the clerics in a country, all the knights in a country, or all the noble families, all these different interests, and they all periodically got together and kind of discussed one against the other how things should go. And the Estates General in the French Revolution is sort of the last gasp of that corporatist movement of medieval Europe. Mussolini takes this a lot farther. Mussolini says, look, what happens in a country is that just think of a Venn diagram. And I tried to draw a Venn diagram on here and I botched it up, so I'm just going to tell you. Just think of a big Venn diagram, and all societies is a big circle. In it, there are all these tiny little circles all over the place. Some of them are circles within circles, and so you've got all the handicraft workers. You've got cobblers. You've got blacksmiths. You've got all these people. Okay. Then you have people who are farmhands, and that's a body. And then you have people who are factory owners, and that's a body. And then you have people who are artists, and that's a body. You have all these different bodies of society. And Mussolini and his fascist philosophy broke this down a lot farther than they did in the Middle Ages. It's so that you've got the society is really a very, very collectivist society, not individualist at all. But it consists of these groups of people. So the role of the state, when Mussolini said everything within the state, he meant all these corpora, all these bodies within the state, and that the state's job was to regulate, and that it would be the honest broker, and it would be an organic part of the machinery. The fascists were big on the word organic. That there would be this kind of organic shaping of society, and so that nobody got the upper hand. The workers wouldn't be paid too little, and the factory owners wouldn't make too much. All of this is just kind of regulated from the state. So the state will work it all out organically, all right? And that's the meaning of this corporatism in fascist Italy. I don't want to go back to Russia just yet. Let me say this. So Mussolini establishes his one-party rule in 1924. It looks like he's going to take Italy into a real left-wing vision of of his fascist movement. It looks like all the old timers, the most radical of the old timers, will take over Italy. They're all talking about, okay, we've done the first revolution, now let's do the second revolution, where we make this country fascist. And Mussolini does in fact say in 1927, now we've done it, the country is fascist. But what he's apparently was attempting to do was to say, okay, it's done, we've gone as far as we need to. Because what he does next, the fascist movement had been so antithetical to the Roman Church. I mean, there's a long history here in which the church and the Italian government had been at odds. The French had, in fact, guarded the Vatican from the rest of Italy. You know that story. It's a long story. And what Mussolini does is to make peace through the Lateran Pact, make peace in late 20s with the church, and says, okay, look, let's agree to disagree. Let's agree to get along here. You confer all the benefits of Catholicism on the Catholics who want it, and we will allow Vatican City to exist and the church to exert its influence, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the Lateran Pact, to many historians, indicate that Mussolini was backing off just a little bit. The totalitarianism that Mussolini installed was not the totalitarianism of Lenin. In other words, the body count just never appeared. If somebody counted up all the political prisoners who were killed, or people who were all killed, officially executed for political reasons in Italy from 1922 until 1945. And that's excluding the German rule during the war and excluding all the, but just the normal time under Mussolini. And I think it came out to 8. Okay? So if you compare that 8, I mean, that's not even getting warmed up for Lenin on a single day. So it's a different kind of regime. Yeah, he did throw some of his opponents in jail, and under Hitler's pressure, he did ship out the Jews and take their stuff and all that. But it's just simply not the kind of totalitarian dictatorship that we see elsewhere. Certainly justifies all that, but it's not exercised like that. I mean, I think of one or two left-wing social theorists who published their works in Italy. It was frankly anti-fascist party, anti-Mussolini, and they were punished with the horrible punishment of being sent to southern Italy as opposed to being able to continue living in Milan. So you get the picture here. This is not the jagged-edged totalitarian regime of the others, but the theory is certainly important and certainly there. And if you've again, I mentioned this book, The Faces of Janus, and we really find that a lot of the totalitarian theory for Mao, for Stalinism, for all these people, to have been worked out in Italy, so that unfortunately, this time too, as with so much in history, Italy has proved a kind of launching pad for ideas in Western civilization. Yes, Tam, I like it. Totalitarianism light, and I think that's an excellent way to put it. So let's go back to totalitarianism not light. Back to Russia for a little bit, and these sections are shorter. As I said at the beginning, I wanted to talk mostly about Mussolini and the Italians today. But let's just go a little bit farther and talk about the Bolsheviks again. We kind of left them hanging on to power, but how did we do it? I just want to go through this and get it on record how all this happens. I think Lenin and the Bolsheviks had a apparently, from just observing things, you'd think they didn't have much chance to win. But here's how they did it. Diplomatically, Trotsky, as the Commissar for Foreign Affairs, went to Brest-Litovsk in White Russia, in Belarus, in February, March 1919, and negotiated away one-third of European Russia to the Germans. Okay? Well, that's one way to do it. He bought with that land, he bought a peace with the Germans. And so the Bolsheviks could now concentrate on fighting anybody else. That should be March 1918. I said that wrong. I see it now. I just typed it wrong. Sorry. I need to go back through all these presentations and correct my typos at some point, and I will need to remember to do that. In fact, I'll write it down. But the next thing is militarily, and that's easily told as well. Trotsky and the Red Army. Trotsky becomes the head of the Red Army, and they create an army that fights the Civil War, fights all comers, all the White Russian generals and admirals who gathered forces and attacked, all of the Allied interventions who gathered forces and attacked, all the neighboring countries who attacked, like Poland in 1920, in the brutal Polish-Soviet War, and Trotsky won. I mean, there's a couple of reasons he did win. He was not a military man, but he was an extremely intelligent person, an extremely capable organizer, and he had the advantage, for one thing, if you think about it, he was attacked from all sides. And this is not always, if you have enough supplies, it's not always a disadvantageous position in military affairs, because this way you can, if your enemies are all around you in a big kind of ring, then you can concentrate all your forces wherever the threat is, and you've got easy communications to all parts. The military theorists call this, and tacticians call these, interior lines. And so that's what he had. The other thing was that Trotsky had the services of the newly founded Cheka, about which more in a minute, and the Cheka simply took all the wheat and rye and barley from the fields and took it away from the peasants and let them starve and then brought it to the Red Army. So that, in many cases, if you wanted to survive, you got in the Red Army. And so Red Army could advertise this really good advantage that you could be fed if you were in the Red Army. And that's another way that it happened. Why did the Allied intervention not work? I mean, for goodness sake, the Americans intervened, the British intervened, the French intervened, the Japanese intervened. The Poles, their war with the Soviets acts as an intervention for sure. How could they stand this? Well, the interventions were all uncoordinated, and in many cases they were at cross purposes. Many of the local commanders of the White Russian forces were hardly better than the Bolsheviks in some cases. They were ready to put some successor of the Romanovs in power and start taking vengeance, and they said so. In some cases, the local people didn't trust them. In a lot of cases, you know, individuals would have a white army go through their territory and rape and kill and steal and all that, and they didn't like that either, so they didn't get much support. As far as the Allies, the foreign interventions that happened were always just a kind of drop in the bucket. It's a huge, huge country, 16 time zones, and there were just too many cross purposes there. In politics, the Bolsheviks hung on to power by means of using what I introduced last time, the idea that they latched onto the Soviet movement, which was not really their movement. But they were able to link themselves to the idea of the Soviets or the Council movement, but at the same time bring the Bolshevik side along with it. They're really two different models. The Soviet model, the Council model, is a Well, it's more like anarcho-syndicalism. It's a ground-up movement. It's from the ground up. So the decisions are made in little councils here, and then they're made at regional councils higher up, and eventually they get to the Supreme Council, the Supreme Soviet. The Bolshevik Party, of course, is the most rigidly top-down organization that could be conceived. And so it's once the party, and converts from the Bolshevik to the Communist Party in 1918, once the party is in power and has its power structure there, and it only uses the Soviet structure in ways that it wants to, and manipulates it and pollutes it, and uses it as a kind of administrative tool to carry out the aims of the Bolshevik Party. So politically, that works very well. Another part of politics was that Stalin became party secretary in 1922, and he carried out some of these functions earlier, as he did all kinds of other jobs as commissar for nationalities and commissar for the Red Army in Georgia and many other things. And so Stalin is there working in the background, by the way, enrolling people into the party and sponsoring them basically, he's the face of the Bolshevik movement, the communist movement, for many people who joined the party in the wave of success, the opportunists who came into the party, they latch on to Stalin, and they're loyal to him, and this helps the Bolsheviks stay in power as we move into the early 20s. Finally, the most effective thing that kept the Bolsheviks in power was the creation of the most ferocious secret police that ever existed. It was given to Felix Dzerzhinsky, one of the old Bolsheviks, to create an extraordinary commission for the countering of spies and countering of opposition, et cetera, et cetera. Cheka is just simply an acronym that comes from the words commission and extraordinary. So it's the Che and a Ka, and so we called it Cheka, and they always called it that. So Dzerzhinsky has the job of fighting anybody who is an opponent of the state. And from the very outset, I've got to mention this, from the very outset, the Bolsheviks ran a show that was absolutely carried out in utter hatred of the peasants, in utter hatred of the countryside. And it's in a country that's 75-80% countryside, too. So as the Bolsheviks take over, they are a party that is devoted to the putting of the peasants in their place, to the taking of their land, to the starvation of the peasants. There's a very, very clear tendency in the Bolshevik leadership to do this, and Dzerzhinsky is no different. I mean, in fact, he uses the Cheka not just to shoot and to kill people in the cities, but to collect all the grain from the countryside, to carry out mass executions and reprisal shootings on the countryside at a rapid rate. And it's not just Dzerzhinsky doing this. Lenin is the most ferocious supporter of this. He's the one who keeps things going along this absolutely pitiless way to power in Russia. It's Lenin who is, and I'd like to quote all the recent authors on this. I mean, Lenin used to have a kind of patina of goodness about him, and a lot of the communist sympathizers wrote, like Christopher Hill wrote a kind of hagiographies of Lenin and what a saint he was. And Lenin also came out of the 1956 Khrushchev 20th Party Congress speech as being kind of a communist saint. But there is no doubt today, if you want to look at a very good book on this, there's a book called Lenin, Stalin, Hitler, by Robert Gelatley. Did I mention this last week? I'm not sure if I did. Gelatley. It's about 5 years old, and it's a huge fat book in which he makes comparisons among these people, and his information on Lenin is quite extraordinary. The extent to which Lenin was pushing for bodies, saying we've got to have more bodies, we've got to have a bigger body count. Robert Gelatley. The extent to which Lenin is driving the whole gruesome program from the beginning, Dzerzhinsky is merely carrying out what, of course, enthusiastically, merely carrying out what Lenin and the Bolsheviks are saying. So once Lenin and his friends are in power, they move on all fronts immediately. There's the assault on religion, where they more or less shut down the Russian Orthodox Church. There is the whole program of war communism, wherein they take Hindenburg program of Ludendorff and carry it out in even more horrific ways. There's the total assault on the bourgeoisie. There's the assault on, I didn't even write down the assault on the aristocracy, who were killed in their hundreds of thousands. There's the assault on the peasants, who were starved out, by all counts, several million during the Civil War. Even the supporters, the Red Sailors of Kronstadt, were turned on in 1921 and massacred. There's the assault on nationalities. Stalin helped carry this out most of all. Well, he was the commissar for nationalities and had written the book on how communists ought to feel about nationalities, and so he carried out these early assaults and would carry those out for his entire career as the greatest of all ethnic cleansers and ethnic killers. So this is how the Bolsheviks stayed in power. They carried out this extreme program, which we don't have time to look at fully, but most of you probably have quite a bit of background in what was going on in these early years of the Soviet regime or the communist regime. Well, Lenin died. He sort of worked himself to death. I mean, when you talk about people working themselves to death, it's often you think of them working themselves in a good cause. But in any case, there were two assassination attempts on him, both by women, by the way, in 1918, one in January and one later in the year. And it looks like, from recent research and recent reports, it looks like that these were both British sponsored attempts, both women and both British sponsored attempts. Were not. We don't have all the information on that yet, but it seems that that was the case. But the assassination attempts didn't get to him. They may have helped him along, because in May 1922 he had the first of his three strokes, and then he carried out this. He gets very suspicious of Stalin in here. So there's a kind of myth that Lenin realized how bad Stalin was. We'll look at that in just a second. But on the other hand, he didn't really say anything except this vague warning against Stalin about his successor to the movement. Just a couple of things about these pictures. There's in the lower right hand corner. There's Stalin at his desk, and this is really the typical Stalin, don't you think? Rather than Mussolini, who's more typically in front of a crowd making a speech, but Stalin has virtually no charisma at all. Trotsky and Lenin and Kamenev in 1919, there's Trotsky, of course, about whom I've spoken, the most capable of all the Bolshevik leaders, and Kamenev, another important leader about whom more later, and then of course Lenin in the middle. And then this photograph of Lennon. And if you get a, if you blow that up a little bit at some point, or are able to, if it's clear enough, you can see that he looks like he's already dead in that picture. He has the strangest look on his face, but this is apparently the last picture made of him, except for before he died. But of course, since they stuffed him and put him on display, and there were plenty of pictures of the dead Lennon. We got to talk about those jokes. I mentioned the political jokes at some point, and got to tell you one about the Lennon's mausoleum at some point, but maybe I'm a little behind today, so I'll do that next time. Peter writes, who grew up in the in communist Czechoslovakia, has a very good comment here. We've been taught in primary school in communist Czechoslovakia that Lennon was a very kind person and leader, that he was the embodiment of kindness itself. That's a good one. It's really the great myth. But you know, you can practically read that in Christopher Hill's. I remember I was a TA in the, about 1980 or so at the University of Virginia in a class. And one of the books assigned in a class I was TAing for, Modern European History, was a biography of Lennon by Christopher Hill. And I've never read anything so ridiculously absurd. And Hill was, in fact, a really competent historian, if a leftist and a socialist, a really competent historian of the English Revolution. But he just dropped out of character there to write this propaganda pamphlet. In fact, it's just a short biography, 100 pages. And it was just the most absurd thing. But yeah, that's part of the whole Lennon mystique, a very kindly guy while he was killing all these people. Cam says, my wife was taught the same thing in Lithuania when it was under the Soviet Union. Well, this is terrific to have you guys in the class to bring this basic, primary information to us. That's terrific. Thanks. There's Lennon's testament, early 1923, and I thought it was important to go through. Here's the appropriate part about Stalin. At one point, Lennon is said to have told somebody that Stalin was a gray blur, that he really didn't like him. But here's what was actually in the testament, which then was kept secret and hidden away and all that. But here's what Lennon said. Stalin is too rude. Now, think about this. Think of who's talking and who he's talking about. Stalin is too rude, and this defect, although quite tolerable in our midst and in dealing with us, dealing among us communists, becomes intolerable in the Secretary General. That's why I suggest that the comrades think about a way of removing Stalin from that post and appointing another man in his stead, who in all other respects differs from Comrade Stalin, having only one advantage, namely that of being more tolerant, more loyal, more polite, and more considerate to the comrades, less capricious, etc. This may be, this circumstance may appear to be a negligible detail, but I think that from the standpoint of safeguards against the split, and from the standpoint of what I wrote above about the relationship between Stalin and Trotsky, it is not a minor detail, but it is a detail which can assume decisive importance. Yeah, Stalin's too rude. You know where this comes from. I mean, in the end, these high and mighty declarers that the individual don't really matter. All this comes from an encounter in which Stalin comes out to the dacha of Lenin in 1922, and Lenin is already in that wheelchair and not really long for this world. And in the course of it, Stalin has an encounter with Lenin's wife, and he's rude to his wife. And so for all of the mayhem and murder and killing and all the horrific pain inflicted on the world by Lenin, he's angry at Stalin for insulting his wife. So I think that's such an exquisite part of the this picture. It's such an irony that I like to see it. That whole scene is described in Robert Conquist's book, Stalin, the Breaker of Nations, which is a great book. So there's a power struggle. It's kind of inevitable, and you saw it reflected in what Lenin said there. And in essence, it's Stalin versus Trotsky. Although at different times, Zinoviev and Kamenev come in on Stalin's side, and then they'll come in on Trotsky's. At first, it's actually with Stalin, and then they switch over when they think Stalin has gotten too strong. But it's too late by that time. In 1925, he's peddling this idea of not world revolution, but socialism in one country. And we know now from the records that he never gave up on world revolution. He just simply said, first, socialism in one country. Trotsky was exiled from Russia in 1928. First to one of the steppe republics of the Soviet Union, and then eventually out of the country altogether. And as I'm sure everybody knows, Trotsky was ended up in Mexico and ended up being murdered by the NKVD in 1940. By 1927, Stalin was in charge, and he denounces deviation from the party line, and the party line will be defined by himself. And in 1928, he's in power with the first five-year plan that features all the usual Stalinist economic features, super heavy industry, a super concentration of industry, ridiculously concentrated power production, and so forth. It's all about the big power things, and all the resources of the country are invested in that kind of thing, full of quotas and all kinds of imaginary incentives. The worst of the worst, you might say, a man who knew absolutely nothing about economics. So we get Stalin in power, and a lot more about him next time. But we got to go back for just a couple of minutes to Germany. We talked a lot about Hitler last time, but let me keep that ball in the air here at the very end, and then we'll start our question and answer, which I think will be very interesting today. Just remember, Hitler took over this tiny German Workers' Party called the DAP, the Deutsche Arbeiterpartei, in 1919, and he converted that into the National Socialist German Workers' Party. And because the first word in that is national, it sounds like Nazi. I mean, that's a typical way that Germans kind of made catchy abbreviations. They called it Sozialistische, whatever, Partei, the Socialists. They called them Sozis back in 1920, 21, and they called these National Sozialistische people Nazis. So that's where we get that word Nazi. And they did use it at the time. You know, in Germany now, they don't like to say that as much. They just say NS, the National Socialist, but Americans somehow like saying the word Nazis. In any case, he took over this party. It grows. He comes into his own as a speaker, tries to take over that Bavarian government. We talked about this last time, November 1923, at the height of the Ruhr crisis, where the French had taken over the Ruhr, and there was chaos there. But the Bavarian state police fire on the Nazis who are trying to take over, and that's when, you know, Ludendorff walked off. He was in that group. But in prison, Hitler writes Mein Kampf, a rambling anti-Semitic, social Darwinist kind of screed that in many cases you can't figure out the meaning of anyway. But he writes Mein Kampf, which becomes one of the most popular unread books ever. And while he's in prison, Hitler puts the crackpot intellectual Alfred Rosenberg in charge. He was famous in the Nazi movement for having written a book, and most of them hadn't written a book. Hitler did in jail. I mean, to get this kind of enhancement of his image. But Rosenberg actually wrote a book that was quite popular in anti-Semitic circles called The Myth of the 20th Century. And but on the other hand, I mean, the argument is that Hitler knew what he was doing. He put this kind of dreamy intellectual Rosenberg in charge. while he was in prison because he didn't want anybody making any changes or taking any initiative with the party. So he becomes, when he gets out, really the best politician of the Weimar Republic. I mean, the National Socialists, the Nazis, used radio, and Hitler zipped around in airplanes, and they used all kinds of really modern techniques. They would target a certain precinct and work it and have parade, rally over a period of 5 or 6 weeks. They'd have people going door to door. They'd have brown shirts there to bust up socialist meetings and things like that. So they really had this clear idea of electoral strategies. And there's one plan that goes to about 1928 where they thought they would try to link the countryside into the movement. Didn't work very well. Changed over to the urban plan to try to gain urban workers in the latter period. That worked a little better. In essence, what we know now, and if you've ever read William S. Allen's book on the Nazi seizure of power in one German town, you'll know that what they wanted was fully engaged party members. They made the party dues for the Nazi Party very, very high, so that if you were in, you'd made a considerable sacrifice just to be in, and so you did the activities. A typical Nazi Party real member before 1933, when everybody started joining once Hitler got in power, 1934. Those original party members, they had something every Saturday. I mean, these were working people, and they had to struggle into those uniforms and get out and march around and do all these things all the time. And this was part of Hitler's idea. I mean, it's very, very interesting. Approach. This particular poster is from that period, the late 20s. National Socialism, it says, the organized will of the nation. The organized will of the nation. And then comes January 1933, where amidst violence, where amidst the depression, which hit Germany like a body blow in 1930, and put people out of work right and left, I'll give you figures on that, some statistics next time as we take this a little farther. But there's January 31st when Hitler, January 30th. I just typed 31st. I've got to correct these two things. Anyway, so we get Hitler in power, and we've discussed some events from his time in power. But I think we'll leave it at that. And turn now to the question and answer, because I think that there are a lot of good things that that we can discuss here. And so, please, let's call this the end of the lecture part and the beginning of the question and answer. And I'll be glad to answer any question that you have, or to try to answer it, or to comment on your comment. It's hard for me to just sit here because I have a little sign up above that says "Speak Now." It's one of the WebEx commands, and it tells me to speak now, as if "Speak Now" or "Forever After Hold Your Peace." So I feel strange not speaking when that's commanding me to speak. So Jeff asks the first question, why were people willing to devote so much time and money to the Nazis? Very good question. I mean, I think what happens here is that the middle class had been wiped out by inflation. There was the World War. People had looked at their country as dissolving. The Weimar Republic had all these aspects to it that seemed degenerate. American jazz flowed in. American jazz dancers flowed in. The movies were all about dissolute prostitutes. The big stories in the newspaper were about sex murders and things like this. And I think that people just thought, our country has gone to hell in a handbag. What can we do against it? And so against all the rest of that, here come these Nazis talking about renewal, and renewal from the ground up, and renewal, and introducing into it this leader, Hitler. And I think he had so much charisma. And, you know, I think, there was certainly a cultural threat to a lot of things that people held dear. And I think Hitler talked to people, and they felt like he was kind of talking to them. You know, my mentor, Hans Schmidt, who was he grew up in Nazi Germany and is left the country. His mother was Jewish, and his father left him in the midst of the Nazi period. So the mother took the two sons abroad. But Schmidt said that one thing he always that always irked him a little bit was hearing these recordings of Hitler as in this real high, you know, this basically it's a false equalization that's like it's coming from an old time radio and it's like that kind of high thing, and Schmidt said their radios didn't pick it up that way at all. That when he was a kid, they heard Hitler on the radio, and it was a deep sort of a vibrant voice. Hitler, there's a couple of good books on this, actually, on how Hitler put together his speeches and how he thought about this, what people have called his mesmerizing and hypnotic way of speaking. And he did some fairly sophisticated things with his voice, inflection, rising when he should have been falling, and falling when he should have been rising, and some other stuff like that. And he had this voice that was kind of persuasive, and people saw him as a kind of a kind of underdog who had been a soldier and all these kinds of things. And so I think there's a lot of way that he built up enthusiasm. He didn't talk about Jews all the time. He certainly was openly anti-Semitic the whole time. I mean, Mein Kampf is openly anti-Semitic, but throughout most of the 20s, he wasn't making speeches about Jews. He was making speeches about how the international bankers had taken over Germany through the Young Plan and the Dawes Plan. And to tell you the truth, you'd be hard pressed to kind of argue against that. They certainly did. The Weimar government wanted to keep going and wanted to keep building swimming pools and concert halls for all the towns so those parties would keep on getting elected. And they did take these loans organized by J.P. Morgan agents in 1924-28. And Hitler was leading the charge against that. So, I mean, people found that very appealing. Remember, these people had all their savings, if any, wiped out in the inflation in 1922 and 1923. So the people who thought something is wrong, and the people who wanted their lives to have some meaning, were looking for something, and this seemed to be the game in town. So I think that they were willing to get in that organization because they wanted to believe in something, and they thought that that was a healthy thing to believe in. You know, there's another reason there, Jeff. I think they spent time and money doing that because very much like the German social democratic culture, the Nazi world, the Nazi organizations, Hitler Youth, Bund Deutscher Mädel, the Nazi Association of Post Office Employees, all of it, all these interlocking things had cultural activities that were also fun. Another thing that Schmidt would often tell us about growing up in Nazi Germany was this. He said that the thing that he regretted most about being 12, 13 years old and in a German school and being Jewish was that his parents would never let him sign up and join the Nazi soccer leagues, because he said that was the best soccer anywhere. He said, I thought I was a really good soccer player and I wanted to be in the best league. So I told my parents, can I sign up for the National Socialist, or whatever it was called? And they said, no, of course not. So, and he probably could have made it in. His father was not Jewish, and so, you know, that he had an opportunity. But in any case, there is that. I mean, it was not, they worked hard, and they went out in these parades and went out these rallies. But, you know, people have their hobbies and their free time and their commitments, and, you know, commitments tend to give meaning to your life and everything. And I think that's what they thought they were doing. That's a really good question, and I think it's, you know, there's a great set of books written by a man named Alphonse Heck, H-E-C-K, Alphonse Heck. And this was a kid during Nazi Germany who became one of the top Hitler Youth leaders. He was an absolute true believer. And I recommend his book, Child of Hitler, unreservedly. It's one of the most honest kind of internal looks at this whole movement. And, you know, there are some drawbacks to the Hitler Youth, but you read about his enthusiasm, how much time he spent getting his uniform together, how much time he spent organizing these excursions as commander of this unit. It's like Boy Scouts times 10. I mean, there's that too. It just had this appeal to people. The National Socialists were sophisticated politicians, and they were also sophisticated, very sophisticated from a cultural aspect in terms of how to persuade people and bring people to them. Okay, Laura says this. These types of violent groups seem to be the norm for the era during and after World War I. Was there such chaos after all was said and done that legitimate governments were too busy to counteract these groups? The reason I ask is that the ending of World War II doesn't seem to encourage the same trend, yet the war was still as destructive and chaotic to society. Wow, that's a great question and a huge and important question. So Laura, I would start on this, and this might take, you know, some years to think about and figure this out. but it certainly is the case that Europe, wherever you went in Europe, there were such groups. In other words, there's a Squadristi and all these returning soldiers, and even more for both the stormtroopers of the Nazi Party, who were kind of, you know, like the brown shirts in the Nazi Party were like the black shirts in the Fascist Party. And both of them drew on returning soldiers who had been on the front, but also younger guys who didn't quite get into the war. This is an important part of that demographic, that a lot of these young guys who did not get into the war had something they thought to prove. And so they joined these tough guy organizations. So they get to be 18 or 19 and, you know, join the tough outfits of Squadristi or brown shirts and go and kick in windows and get in street fights with socialist fighting groups. Well, the socialists had fighting groups, too. They had paramilitaries as well, as did the communists. So there was a lot of street fighting, and so that was part of it. So. Was there such chaos, you say, Laura, that the legitimate governments were too busy to counteract these groups? Well, I think they in part tried, and in part they used the groups. I mean, the original Weimar government used a lot of Freikorps-type groups to put down the socialists, and then, you know, and then Hitler's group just got out of hand. I mean, it's a complicated history. So I don't know that they were too busy or if they served a function. You know, the Squadristi were serving a real function for factory owners and landowners in Italy. So in a way, it's a kind of symbiosis. They didn't really put an end to them because they didn't want to put an end to them. They served a function. The part about World War II is interesting, it's true there weren't that many such groups, especially in occupied Germany or someplace like that. But you know, on the other hand, if you read that novel Ashes and Diamonds about Poland, written by a person who was in Poland at the end of World War II, 1945, 46, 47. One of the outstanding features of that book is actually youth gangs of people who went around in this violent atmosphere and sort of turned to gang life. And I might point out that this was that gangs flourished in America and other places, in Latin America and other places too. So there is something, but you're right. It's not the same thing. I don't think. I mean, I don't think there's a connection, but it is a very interesting comparison. I don't think I can do it justice here today. I'll have to think about this some, but maybe I'll come up with some better answer. If you come up with one, let me know. We'll put it out. You know, this I don't think this group is very active on the forum. So you know, if I'm looking at that forum every couple of days, and so if you've got questions and things in between time, be sure to ask or talk with your fellow students about it. That'd be great. And Jeff says, yeah, way of life, certainly. Leslie asks, to what extent was the rise of Nazism a reaction to the killings that the Bolsheviks were carrying out in Russia? That's an excellent question. It's a complicated one. There's a famous German historian, Ernst Nolte, N-O-L-T-E, who in the 1980s, the late 80s, wrote a book in which he said that the direction was quite direct between the Bolshevik killings and then the rise of the Nazis. That his contention was that Hitler was both imitating and reacting to, that there's two things going on. Nolte was piled on by the historical profession, and even good scholars today still have to say, oh, I don't agree with Nolte on any of this. Jill Attlee does this in the introduction to his book. I don't want to be connected with him. But Nolte certainly had a substantial point. For one thing, Hitler always had, there was a Communist Party in Germany, and it was quite closely connected with the Bolshevik Party. In fact, there were certain communists who were in both revolutions, both in Germany and in Russia. And so there were some very direct connections between the communist groups in both places. And although I'm going to say in the coming weeks that I don't believe Hitler was totally devoted to the destruction of the Communist Party in the way and totally devoted to anti-communism in the way that scholars sometimes and historians sometimes say, nonetheless, he was against communists for the moment. He was against Bolsheviks for the moment because he thought they were associated with Jews, for sure. And he thought that they had been involved in the stab in the back during the war and all that. So in that degree, there is certainly a connection. And certainly there's a connection. I mean, think of it. If I'm sure you already have thought of this, that once the war itself kind of broke into this new territory of mass killing. I mean, look at how many more civilians were killed in World War I than soldiers. There are people being killed. There's ethnic cleansing that's developed over the last 50 years before 1920, and that's just getting worse. In other words, World War I is the period when ethnic cleansing rises in full view. Armenians are murdered in mass numbers in Turkey. Jews and Germans are murdered in mass numbers in Russia. That's before the Bolshevik Revolution. Ukrainians get massacred by several different groups of people. So there's a lot of this going on. And so, yes, it was certainly a part of the atmosphere. And the Germans had seen a lot of this. There hadn't been much mass killing in Russia, except for the war funds. I mean, that's mass killing for sure. But they had been involved in the struggle for Upper Silesia, the struggle for the Baltic. They had fought communists in the Baltic. And so this was certainly a part of the picture. And in the fighting in Germany, in the early Weimar Republic, in other words, all these struggles between the left and the right and all these different groups in the period 1919 to 1923, there had been some extremely ugly things that took place on both sides. A lot of atrocities committed in German streets, in German cities in that period that really makes you shudder. I mean, there's some pictures in the Bundesarchiv, the German Federal Archives, of the hostages that the communist government in Munich, there's a communist takeover in Munich, and those the government, that was overthrown, but the last communist holed up in a gym and had some hostages, and there's just absolute mutilation of these people and torture before they were killed. So this happens, and then it happened on the other side. I mean, Rosa Luxemburg, the communist leader, was just simply shot and thrown in a canal in Berlin. This brutalization was certainly a part of it, and in that regard, then there's a connection. That's a big question too. I love it. Your questions are great. So Leslie, I hope that will be good for the moment. But again, let's discuss this online if we don't come up with something satisfactory. Kim says, speaking of Hitler's speeches on radio, there's a good document on this, High Tech Hitler. Oh, excellent. I'll take a look. Hope everybody does. Cam says, did the Nazis learn how to use propaganda from the Wilson administration? You know, I'm not sure. I think that they really had that going before they had found out much about Wilson. You know, I did my dissertation on the border plebiscites that took place in three different areas on Germany's borders after the First World War. And I was really surprised at the extent to which they were using, first of all, mobile theaters to propagandize the masses. They were, I mean, say propaganda, it was just a campaign to get people in the borderlands to vote either for Germany or Poland or for Germany or Denmark in these areas. And I was surprised at the extent to which, of course, the radio stations weren't established then, so the only electronic medium was film. But they would drive out to these places and put the screen on the side of a truck and put up a projector and have somebody play the piano, and they'd have films doing this sort of thing. So there's a kind of high-tech background there anyway. Radio, of course, really doesn't come about until after the war. The very first radio stations, BBC's 1920, and then slowly after that radio, or not slowly, but within, it takes about 5 years before you get all these countries to have radio stations. So in a way, Hitler, I mean, it's like latching on to new technology now. It's like fundraising on the internet. You just have the new technology, and your movement is new, and you're forward thinking, and you use that kind of thing. So it's very much analogous to that. So I don't think it's from the Wilson administration. I think it's more just coming up all around people. Jeff says, given the incredible value found in the writings of Mises, I am baffled as to why he is not more widely read and acclaimed. Can you shed some light on this? You know, this is a constant, grab your popcorn. This is a constant sort of lament, and I've spent my life thinking about this, but I still don't have a good explanation. I think somebody, might have been you, Jeff, asked me in that about this during that course on the history of inflation, and I didn't have a very good answer then, as I recall, and I don't have a very good answer now. I mean, it's I don't know, just the sign of the times, or the extent to which people can't quite internalize what they read, or can't, in many cases these days, of course, people can't read what they read. I mean, they really can't get the meaning out of it. And so I think there are multiple reasons. I think that the system, the state has such an extended system that starts with the kindergarten, and that in its propaganda, in its worldview, it marginalizes Mises, and that's pretty hard to fight against. You have to grab onto new technologies. You really have to do that, which is, of course, what we're doing right at this moment. So I think that's my version of it this time, Jeff. I don't know what I said last time, but that maybe that will do. Okay, Matthew says, in the European history course I took by David Gordon, he mentioned that Mussolini had a relatively laissez-faire approach to the economy for the first year or so. Do you know if this was an intentional move by Mussolini, or did he just not initially have the infrastructure to implement his economic control? Well, I don't know why Mussolini did that. It's certainly true that, again, I mean, if you think about it, he was in a coalition government, and he didn't have anything like complete control of the country. I think his estimates of totalitarianism as being, you know, the wave of the future, I don't think there was ever any way that there would be a laissez-faire economy. But of course, you don't get the whole story at the time. And so it's easy to see in Mussolini, well, he's not changing the economy. Maybe he doesn't want to change the economy. But I think that's probably it. He just took it easy. He was in that coalition government until 1924, and he was hobnobbing with a lot of industrialists and so forth. Maybe they persuaded him to do this. I mean, in the end, his regime did have some elements of, let's say, a bit of a free market in it. Italy was never the economic control dream of Nazi Germany, and Nazi Germany was never the economic control dream of the Soviet Union. So there are different degrees here. But yeah, at the beginning he was thought to be a little bit laissez-faire, but that didn't last all that long. How about some more questions? We're up to six, but we could easily do a couple more questions. I'm not convinced we're done. Maybe somebody should ask something or raise an issue. You may be typing now. You may be typing now. Let's see. Down here. Okay. Did Mises favor U.S. entry into World War II? That's a good question. You know, I just don't... I'm trying to think. I don't recall any time at which he commented on this issue. Danny, do you, or does somebody else on here remember that? I can't remember any time which he commented. And judging from his attitudes in the wartime books, liberalism, bureaucracy, our book here, Omnipotent Government. I uh, I think he thought that the system was so out of whack that, that somebody had to come in, had to step in. I mean, I don't, but I may be just not remembering. Does anybody remember this? This is an appeal to all. Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, for one thing, it wasn't any of his affair. I mean, he was off at that point teaching in Geneva and was concerned with a whole different set of issues, and was in the in the very deepest part of economics and all that. Let's see. Yeah, that one, so Danny, I don't know if you remember this. I just don't think that Mises ever made any pronouncements about this. I don't think he ever commented. And again, if you read Omnipotent Government, there's not really much foreign affairs in that, in any case. So, yeah, I think until we find out more, we don't. I'm going to stick with my answer. I believe he thought it was just as well that they did. In fact, he suggests this in Omnipotent Government that, there's because of the totalitarians and because of Omnipotent Government, somebody has to step in. And he was talking about, he's calling them democracies, remember? And Mises is using democracy to mean what Popper would mean by open government or what somebody else would mean by pluralistic government. So Mises is actually, in a sense, discussing it. I'm going to say he didn't mind the United States coming in. Okay? Peter says, how was Hitler involved in politics during the Bavarian communist regime just after World War I? I heard he was an agent informer. Well, he was an agent. Here's how Hitler got into the political business. Hitler's at the end of the war, Hitler was blinded by he's had a gas attack. It's not clear why he was blinded in a gas attack. That usually wasn't a symptom, but he was blinded at the end of the war. And he stayed in the military, and while all these other people were being rifted, as they say, and demobilized, Hitler actually stayed in the military and got a job with military intelligence, and basically that job was going to be to infiltrate the anti-state groups on the left and right. But Hitler obviously had more personal motivation and more interest in infiltrating the right, and indeed when he infiltrated this German Workers' Party, he liked it pretty well. I heard a story from a student of mine, an older student of mine, one time in 79 or 80, who had gotten the story from somebody else who had actually been in one of these early party meetings, actually for the U.S. Army, another infiltrator. Wouldn't that be funny if all the earliest meetings were all just infiltrators there at the party meeting playing like they were Nazis? But anyway, this story, which is now secondhand to me, secondhand, and maybe third hand. But this guy said that Hitler was just sort of at the thing and just kind of casually took up the platform to speak to this small gathering and just sort of gained steam as he went. And by all the biographical accounts, this is the way it worked. He just got interested in that and found that, I mean, he'd never spoken to groups before, and he found out that he was good at it and therefore got interested in this party. It was his cause, his kind of people, and all that. So he was involved in the DAP from early 1919 on. Then he changed the name to the NSDAP and all that. So he was violently opposed to the Bavarian communist regime, and I don't recall any of his activities. At that point, I think he was already out of the army and therefore was not infiltrating anybody else. I think he was still leading the party. The point at which he terminated his employment with the Bavarian Army, I do not know. But I've always assumed it was sometime March, April, May 1919. So Jeff says both Mussolini and Hitler were secret agents. Well, yes. Yes, they were. So Hitler for the Bavarian government, Mussolini for the British, and in a sense for the French. And here's another one. Think about this. Lenin's a secret agent of the German government. Trotsky, possibly a double agent. Possibly Trotsky was taking money from both the Germans and and indirectly from some American sources too. That gives you pause, doesn't it? This whole business of all the main totalitarians being secret agents. Yeah, okay. So Laura says, so is the joke about Lenin's mausoleum. Okay, well, let me see. You know, I may have to practice this a little before next time. It's been years since I've thought of this joke. Yeah, I'm going to think about it. I'll open with this next week. It's a good joke. I hate to botch it up, so I'll open with it next week. Matthew says, in omnipotent government, Mises said, this Second World War would never have broken out if the Nazis had expected to encounter on the first day of hostilities a united and adequately armed front of Great Britain, France, Russia, the United States, and all the small democracies of Europe, yet led by unified command. So, yeah, that's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking he was just as happy with U.S. involvement once the thing had happened. So Peter said, so they were all agents of someone. Is that the reason why they were so scared of spies? Well, I think so. And, I mean, all of these subterranean movements lived and breathed. I mean, Peter, you know this from that's what's formed so much of the whole communist world is spy versus spy, as Cam says. All these agent provocateurs in one place or the other. It goes way back in Russian history. You know, the guy who started the Russian Revolution of 1905, Father Gapon, well, it turns out he was working for the Okhrana. And so he was an agent, he was carrying out a provocation, that is to say, leading people into the streets so they would get shot. This is a part and parcel of the thing. Everybody agents of someone, and so they're all pretty scared. I mean, you know, we know that if there was anybody more paranoid about his personal security, there is, by the way, an excellent article written by Peter Hoffman on Hitler's personal security. And needless to say, it was pretty extensive. And plus, he had this sort of sixth sense of, you know, avoiding all these bombs and plots and everything. And if there's anybody who had more of that than Hitler, it was certainly Stalin, who, suspected basically everybody of everything. That's the one, Laura, on the security, right? The Hitler security. Okay, I will. If I don't write it down, I won't do it. Yes, I will put that up. Very good. It's very interesting. Well, gang, I think we're at the 6:10 mark now. And here's a question. Rothbard said that Mises didn't discuss foreign affairs in his seminar, but that probably refers to American post-war foreign affairs in particular. Yeah. Yeah, I think, and people change their minds on things like this. And I'll tell you what, I mean, somebody's opinions in the middle of that war, from the position that Mises was occupying as a person who had been driven from his country, and as I mentioned, a person who was sort of uniquely opposed by all the available totalitarians. It doesn't surprise me that he thought it was a good thing that the Americans intervened. And I mean, this is an insight you have to come to after long years of study. You know, people, I've known people all my life, people of the best will in the world, the best instincts in the world. People were just sort of instinctively, you know, against collectivism and everything. He thought it was a good thing that that the United States intervened. So, yeah, I think that's a good that's a good thing to look at here. I mean, and the other thing is that, that Mises is, you know, a great scholar, but, you know, this is not Holy Writ. So we can agree with, we can disagree with Mises on issues too. Any other questions? Or maybe we're going to shut down after I said we can disagree with Mises on things too. Maybe that's the end of my tenure here at the Mises Academy. But, well, there I've said it. Any other questions or comments? Well, I say let's call it a night, and it's pretty late right now in the UK and other points. Where is it the latest? Is it isn't it tomorrow somewhere? Isn't somebody, or do we have several of us who are listening to this tomorrow? I think we do. So. If so, I, you know, have a good Monday, and some others of us will have a good Sunday evening. Okay, well, thank you. Thank you. Thanks very much. Thanks so much. Goodbye, everybody. Thank you. Thanks for being here and asking these good questions especially. Thanks. And I'm going to sign off now.